Thanks very much. It's been a very educational experience for me here. Okay, so let me just tell you what I'm starting with. The data is an n-dimensional complex vector space, and a subgroup, a finite subgroup of the general linear group, which is generated by the set of reflections it contains. So that's the set of S and W, so that the dimension of the fixed space of S is exactly n minus 1. So some people call these pseudo-reflections or unitary reflections, something like that. I guess I haven't fixed the inner product on my vector space, so. Okay. So then for each element S and T, I'm going to fix, first of all, a linear form, alpha sub S, whose zero set is exactly equal to the fixed space of S, and also a complex number, C sub S. And I want these to be conjugate on conjugate Z classes. So C WS, WN versus CS for all reflections and all elements of the group. Okay, so given that data, I'm going to define the Dunkel operators. For elements of the vector space, and by giving their action on functions. So d sub y is a Dunkel operator, and if you have a function on the vector space, then the Dunkel operator gives you back the derivative of that function in the direction y minus the sum over all the reflections of c sub s, and then alpha s evaluated on y times f minus s of f over alpha s. Okay, so this here, okay, let me say where things are living. So f is a polynomial function on V, and delta y, I said this, but let me write it down. Delta y is a partial derivative in the direction y. Just like in a multivariable calculus class, which I haven't taught for a long time. Okay, the theorem, not somewhat surprising fact about these if you've never seen them before, and this is due to Dunkel. And I guess that's in the case of real reflection groups, and then Dunkel and Optum in the case of complex reflection groups, is the dy's all commute with one another. So if you take two different vectors, then the corresponding Dunkel operators commute with one another. There's a very nice proof of this and some notes that Eddinghoff and Ma just put on the archive a few months ago. Okay, so now I can tell you what the central player of the talk today is, the rational Chrebnik algebra. H, let me write HC. It depends on C. It really also, of course, depends on the group W, so some people like to write HC of W. Some people also put V into the notation because W is not just an abstract group, but it's given as a subgroup of GLV. Anyway, the rational Chrebnik algebra HC is the algebra of operators on C of V, which is generated by the Dunkel operators, dy, for all vectors y in the vector space. Multiplication by f for all polynomial functions f on this vector space, and the group. And it, because of the fact that these guys commute, I get a presentation theorem for H. It has a very nice PBW property, which is that as a vector space, HC is isomorphic to polynomials on the dual spaces. Well, let me write this. So polynomials on V tensor the group algebra of W tensor polynomial functions on V dual. So this bit here is the Dunkel operators, the subalgebra generated by the DYs. It's this part. And there's two important subalgebras here that are visible from this presentation. This here is a twisted group ring, isomorphic to a twisted group ring, which I'd like to write as C of V dual semi-direct product W. And you should think of that as playing like the role that the part of the enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra generated by the Borel plays. So you can use this part to build representations, to build induced representations of the entire Cherepnik algebra. Okay. I'm going to let E be the symmetrizing idempotent for the group, and E sub det be the determinant version of this symmetrizing idempotent. And there's two properties that are going to be important for the rest of this talk. One is that it may happen that the two-sided ideal generated by E is everything. And the second property, so property star is just that the two-sided ideal generated by E is the entire Cherepnik algebra. Of course, that happens whenever the Cherepnik algebra happens to be simple as a ring. And the second property is a little bit more complicated. Let me make sure I get this exactly right. That E HC E det HC E equals E HC E and E det HC E HC E det equals E det HC E det. Okay, so note that star star definitely holds, provided that, for instance, if you knew that E H det, sorry, that H C E det H H C, if that were equal to H C, and the similar thing for and star holds, then star star holds. These are going to be the kinds of equalities that one has to check in order to get interesting relations to geometry. So let me explain that now. So let me say what the Hilbert scheme is, more or less. The Hilbert scheme of n points in C2 is the scheme whose points are in codimension n ideals in the coordinate ring of C2. So you should sort of think of a point of the Hilbert scheme as being like a collection of endpoints where you've allowed some of them to collide, perhaps. But you keep track of how they collided. Okay, so then the connection to the geometry of the Hilbert scheme that I want to focus on today is due to Kashivar and Rukier. So they assume that W is the symmetric group And the theorem says that then there is a sheaf AC tilde of non-commutative algebras. On the Hilbert scheme, I'm going to write the Hilbert scheme like this. I should have written it up there. Hilban of C2 such that. So first of all, the spherical subalgebra can be realized as something like global sections of this. Of this sheaf, and I'm going to be a little bit vague about what exactly endomorphism in what sense I mean here. And secondly, if this property star star holds for all C plus M, where M ranges over all positive integers, then there is an equivalent. Then there are equivalences, are inverse equivalences. Between E, H, C, E modules and certain category of modules. Let me write it this way: mod good of A, C. And in one direction, so for those of you who know about Balanchine-Bernstein localization, this is an exact analog of that. Except, of course, the Hilbert scheme is not a cotangent bundle, but it is a symplectic variety. And this sheaf of algebras is not exactly a sheaf of differential operators, but it locally looks like that. So that's the sense in which this is an analog of Balanchine-Bernstein. All right, and there's also the approach to this problem of realizing the connection between representations of the Cherednik algebra and the geometry of the Hilbert scheme. Gordon and Stafford have a different way of connecting the two things. All right. So obviously, in order to apply this theorem, if you want to actually study representations of the Cherednik algebra geometrically for some particular value of the parameter C, then you need to know when condition star star holds. And actually, also condition star. This condition star is exactly, let me write this. Write a little bit of explanation about condition star. This holds if and only if the map which sends a module to EM is an equivalence between HC modules and EHCE modules. So representation theoretically, the right way to think about star is that it's telling you exactly when these two algebras are Morita equivalent. Okay, so if you put together star and star star, if you really know when those things hold, then they tell you quite a bit about how far you can, they tell you when you can translate representation theoretic questions about the Cherednik algebra into geometric questions about the Hilbert scheme and the sheaf of algebras, which, as I said, it's a pretty explicit sheaf. I mean, okay, it depends on what you mean by explicit, but it's quite a bit like it really. I mean, it really is essentially differential operators, at least locally. Okay, so. Right, so now what about star and star star? So this is a theorem that was first
proved modulo epsilon by Gordon and Stafford, and then by, and then the epsilon was taken care of by Zadrokovnikov and Ettinghoff. Which is that star holds if and only if C is not an element of the set negative K over M, where K is less than M, is at most N. Those are integers. So again, we're assuming that W still in this. Sorry, this is assumed. W is a symmetric group. In the symmetric group case, there's really only one parameter. There's only one concrete class of reflections, right, consisting exactly of the transpositions. So C is just a number, and Gordon Stafford and Bezrikovnikov Ettinghoff prove that star holds exactly if this condition is satisfied. And star, well, okay, the answer to star can be deduced from this. It's if and only if C minus 1 is not in that set. So combining these theorems gives a Balanchine-Bernstein style localization for HC and E, HC, E. Okay, I should point out that I don't know that anybody has actually used this to prove the analog of something like, for instance, the Kazhdan-Luzdik conjectures. Those are known. It may just be the reason that nobody's done that is that they're already known. So it wouldn't be, maybe there's not enough glory in it for the people who already know how to use these techniques. But still, I think it would be good to have another proof. So I'm going to say more about what the analogs of Verma modules and irreducible modules are in a little bit, and maybe that would be a better time to discuss that point. Okay. So let me say a little bit more. I'm not going to be very precise about how this sheaf of algebras is constructed, but let me say what allows its construction to be possible. Oh yeah, sorry. I meant to not use the bottom of that board. Okay, let me write here. Is that part okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So we can realize that the Hilbert scheme has a certain GIT quotient of a cotangent bundle. Let me tell you how that works. Or really a Hamiltonian reduction. So if you take the quiver, which has two vertices and a loop here and an arrow going that way, and then take its space of representations. Oh, and I want to put, I guess, dimension vector 1, n here. So I take an n by n matrix and a vector, and then I take the cotangent bundle of that, and then I mod out by all base change, the base change group at that vertex. After using appropriate moment map. So I really want to just look. Yeah. So this is for those of you who know this is the if you use a moment map for the base for it's really just GLN action on this space of representations, the zero fiber of that is the commuting variety, and this is the usual relationship between the Hilbert scheme and the commuting variety. Okay, and so AC arises from the differential operators. On this space of this representation space.
Okay, so this same, exactly the same approach should be able, should be possible for a certain, another class of complex reflection groups.
So if W is the group GR1N, what that means is it's all N by N monomial matrices whose entries are Rth roots of 1.
Monomial means there's exactly one non-zero entry in each row and each column. So an example of this, a typical thing would be like 0, I, minus 1, 0. This would be NG, 4, 1, 2. And the symmetric group is G1, 1, N. And of course, the classical Weyl groups are in this family. This 1, I might replace that 1 by a P. And then the connection to geometry becomes a little more tenuous. But in any case, most questions about the representation of theory of the Chretnik algebra for GRPN can be reduced to corresponding questions for GR1N, so I'm not going to talk about that case. So then the appropriate quiver is a cyclic quiver with R vertices. I guess I'll, since I just did R equals 4, I'll stick with that. So take four dots with a, and then connect them with edges with a cyclic orientation, and then add an extra dot with an arrow going in there. That's the appropriate, and then take representations of this where you put a 1 there and N's everywhere. So now I take four N by N matrices and a vector, and then take the appropriate GIT quotient of the cotangent bundle, and that's going to be a certain quiver variety, which has the same relation to the GR1N Chretnik algebra, we hope, as the Hilbert scheme does to the G11N Chretnik algebra. But again, the same questions are going to arise. So I think that most of what Kashiwara and Rukia does will go through. But again, these two conditions, star and star star, are going to have to be checked, or they're analogs for the GR1N Chretnik algebra. So now I want to spend the rest of today talking about how you check those conditions. So now we need to checking star and star star. And actually, it's really enough to check star. As I said before, so there are automorphisms of the Chretnik algebra, which interchange those two idempotents, the symmetrizing idempotent and the determinant idempotent. It's not quite an automorphism of the Chretnik algebra, but isomorphism between the Chretnik algebra at one parameter and the Chretnik algebra at a different parameter that interchange those two idempotents. So if you know the answer for the trivial idempotent, you know it also for the sine idempotent. That is, if you know exactly, if you have the analog of this theorem for the trivial idempotent, then actually you have it for all idempotents. And so let me just mention the first reduction. Say how this goes. So there are standard modules, or Verma modules, corresponding to the irreducible representations of the underlying group. So the definition is that delta sub c of lambda is the induced module, just like you would define for a Lie algebra, the induced module from this twisted group ring CV star semidirect W of S to the lambda for each S to the lambda, for each irreducible W module S to the lambda. as a vector space. This is just isomorphic to polynomial functions on V tensored S to the lambda, or you could think of that as polynomial functions on V with values in the representation S to the lambda. In fact, this is not just a vector space isomorphism, but an isomorphism as modules over this over the subrings of, this actually is C, polynomial function semi-direct W modules. So the only subtlety is how the Dunkel operators act here. And they act essentially by the same type of divided differences that I wrote down before. Okay. So the point of these modules is that, well, they don't generate the category of all modules for the Trednik algebra. Like you can't get all modules for the Trednik algebra by just taking finite direct sums of these things and taking quotients and submodules. But they still contain enough information so that you can answer questions like when does star, star, star hold. So let me say how that goes. LC of lambda is defined to be the head of this module delta C of lambda. So you take delta C of lambda and you mod out by the radical of delta C of lambda, that is the intersection of all maximal submodules. That turns out to be simple. That's not too hard to check. And in fact, the radical of delta C of lambda is exactly equal to the radical of a certain contravariant form on delta C of lambda. So I'm not going to define this now. But for those of you who know a little bit of Lie theory, it's exactly the same type of definition as a contravariant form on a Verma module. OK, so there's lots of questions about these irreducible modules that we don't know. Like, for instance, when are they finite dimensional? That's known only, as far as I'm aware, in the SN case. I mean, there are lots of examples of finite dimensional modules outside of the SN case. But as of right now, I think we're getting closer to understanding them for this infinite family, GR1n, but in general, I think there's not even a conjecture about when those modules are finite dimensional. So in other words, we don't know what the analog of dominant weights are in this situation. That's just an indication of how pathetic the state of knowledge or representation theory of Trednik algebras is as of right now. Okay, so the observation, which is not very deep, but still very useful, is that this condition fails, star fails. In other words, HC is not equal to HC if and only if there's some LC of lambda which is killed by E. So that you can find some representation of the underlying group so that when you build this induced module and its irreducible head, that head is killed by E. I.e., another way of putting it is that E times, if and only if, E times delta C of lambda is contained in the radical of this contravariant form. Okay, so there's a computational criterion for checking now. The form, if you want to know whether this condition holds, you take all the symmetric polynomials in here and you compute their pairings with each other and you compute the radical of that pairing. It's actually a pairing that's, it makes different degrees orthogonal. So at least you can sort of check it degree by degree for small degrees. Yeah?
Is anything known about the representation
theory? No, I mean, as I said, well, yeah, some things are known. I mean, there are certain special values of C for which interesting character formulas are known. So for instance, if you take lambda to be the trivial module and C to be 1 over the Coxeter number for any complex reflection group, then this module is a nice quotient of the diagonal covariant ring. But that's sort of the simplest case of a finite dimensional module where we really know everything about it. In fact, I mean, it's really the only uniform case, uniform across all complex reflection groups that we know about. I guess I shouldn't have said C equals 1 over H. It's C equals H plus 1 over H. And then this module has dimension exactly H plus 1 to the N with all these other properties predicted by Hammond for real groups anyway. It still exists for complex reflection groups. It still has nice combinatorial properties, but it's somewhat more complicated. H plus 1 to the N, where H is the Coxeter number. But that's a very special case. I mean, it's much nicer than you expect in general for finite dimensional modules. Okay, so let me say for these groups GR1N how you can decide about this. Okay, so now for W equals GR1N, there's a some extra rigid combinatorial structure, which is that there's a basis of orthogonal functions with respect to this contravariant form for each standard module. So there exists an orthogonal basis, which consists of eigenfunctions. For a commutative subalgebra of HC, an orthogonal basis with norms given by explicit product formulas. Explicit products of linear factors. So the idea is that if you want to figure out information about the radical of some bilinear form, well, you should diagonalize it. Okay, so then together with Charles Dunkel, we computed the norms of the symmetric versions of these things. So let me first say E times delta C of lambda has a basis consisting of some polynomials G sub S, where S is a column strict tableau on lambda. Okay. This requires a little bit of explanation. Lambda here, the appropriate indexing set for the appropriate indexing set for the representations of this group, this monomial matrix group that I'm talking about, is not partitions anymore, but R tuples, sequences of R partitions, where the total number of boxes is N. And then column strict tableau here, I'm not going to say exactly what I mean by that. There are certain congruence conditions. Essentially, you want it's sort of what you would think it is. It's a filling of each of these, which is weakly increasing left to right. I'm using the English notation for partition. So strictly increasing left to right, weakly increasing left to right, strictly increasing top to bottom. And then there are congruence conditions. You want the entries of the I partition here to be congruent to I modulo R. That's all. So anyway, there's a basis with explicit product formulas for the norms. And then I guess I'll write part B of the theorem over here. So the product formulas, they look like, just to give you an idea, there's no way I have time to do even one example. I mean, it's quite complicated. But the flavor of them is that they look like hook length products. So if it were just in the Sn case, I would essentially be getting a product overall. So if I took, if I wanted to compute the norm of, say, the minimal degree guy in here, I would be taking essentially a product over all boxes and then something having to do with the hook length at that box. And arm and leg length. I mean, it's the usual sort of thing you expect when you do sort of Jack polynomial combinatorics. And a similar thing works, similar but somewhat more complicated thing works for the GR 1N case. Okay, so part B is that HCEHC is not equal to HC if and only if one of two things holds. Either one. Oh, so first of all, let me say what C is. C, now for these groups, is a tuple. There are conjugacy classes of reflections, and C is a tuple consisting of C0 and some numbers B sub L, where L ranges over all integers, but DL is equal to DL prime if L is equal to prime mod R. So it's really only, there's really only R pieces of data here. And I also, there's sort of a normalization condition. I want D0 plus D1 and so on up to DR minus 1 to sum to 0. Sorry, that's just a digression on the how to interpret the parameter.
Is that too low?
Anyway, it's not that important. Just it's not important exactly what these conditions are. The point is that there's that this is how I'm labeling my parameters, just to give you an idea. So the first way that this condition star can fail is that C0 is in the set of minus K over M, where K is strictly less than N, M, almost N. Or the second condition is somewhat more complicated. There exists an integer L between 0 and R minus 1, an integer M between N minus 1, negative N minus 1 and N minus 1, and an integer K between 1 and L plus the square root. I'm going to get this wrong if I don't cheat. Of N plus 1/4 M squared minus 1/2 M minus 1, all of that times R. With K equals DL minus DL minus K plus R M C naught. Okay. This condition looks quite, I mean, it's explicit, but it looks quite mysterious, right? Especially if you're an algebraist, all of a sudden you see a square root and an inequality appearing. Maybe you get a little scared, like I do. But the point here is that rectangular boxes are playing a very special role in this theorem. And the way that you could interpret this second thing is that there's a rectangular partition with at most n parts. M is supposed to be the content of its lower right-hand box. And then when you place it in position L here, it winds up being a sort of special, it winds up corresponding to a special finite dimensional representation for a smaller trendic algebra. And I haven't completely understood why this turns out to be important. I mean, I know where it comes into the proof, of course, but it's still somewhat mysterious to me that you get all of the A spherical values by looking at just those representations. So part A here, Let me say a little bit about the strategy of the proof of this. Part A gives you a necessary condition for C to be aspherical, because if C is going to be aspherical, the norms of all of these guys have to be zero. The norms of every symmetric polynomial have to be zero if C is going to be, sorry, if condition star is going to fail. That's what I mean by aspherical. And then on the other hand, we can explicitly construct some irreducible modules which are aspherical. And as it turns out, the ones that we can construct have to do with rectangular partitions. And miraculously, the sufficient condition we get by that construction is exactly the same as the necessary condition that we get using the norm formula. Okay, so that's sort of lucky. I mean, I knew we would get both necessary and sufficient conditions before I started doing these calculations, but I had no idea they would be the same. Okay, so let me now show you a picture. This here, this is for W equals G212. So that's the Weyl group of type B2. These pink hyperplanes are the places where the where the condition star fails. And the way that you should imagine doing Balanchine-Bernstein style localization is you pick a point in this picture that corresponds to a certain Tredegnick algebra, and then you want to move off in some direction without ever touching one of these pink hyperplanes. And if you can do that, then you're going to get this nice equivalence of categories between Tredegnick algebra modules and modules for this sheaf of algebras. So for instance, if you start here or here or here and then move off in that direction, everything is fine. But if you start somewhere in this complicated region here, it's much more delicate. And in fact, if you start back here and the wrong kind of integrality conditions hold, it won't work. Yeah. Let me continue the glorious tradition of finishing early.